call to order the regular meeting and public hearing of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, December 8th, 2016. First item of business is to approve tonight's agenda. Do I have a motion?
So.
Motion by Commissioner Leckie in a second.
I'll second.
Second by Commissioner Gildersleeve. And any changes to tonight's agenda? Hearing none, all those in favor of tonight's agenda say aye.
Aye. Aye.
The agenda is approved. Next item of business is to approve the minutes for the November 10th, 2016 Planning Commission meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Motion by Commissioner Leckie and a second by Commissioner Von Trapp. Any discussion or comments or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes for November 10th say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? The minutes are approved unanimous. Next item of business is public comment on non-agenda items. Does anybody from the public wish to comment on something that is not on tonight's agenda? Seeing no one, we will move on to item number four, which is the public hearing updates to the parks element of the comprehensive plan. Mr. McCarty, would you like to begin?
Sure. It's fairly brief because we are a member of the public. I want to say thank you to Judy Belanco, Chair of the Parks Commission, for coming. What I'll do is I'll let you know what the Planning Commission has considered that the Parks Commission didn't provide in their recommendations. What's the easiest way to see this? On the table here or taped up to the board?
It's up there on the board.
Okay. So I am just using one map to show this. There's actually three maps that are being amended, but we're just kind of putting it all together on one here because otherwise it gets a little cumbersome. So Judy, just to get you, give you orientation, Parks Commission recommendations provided to the Planning Commission at their last meeting. They had a few comments that we've incorporated into the text, which is they wanted to add a dog park to the city's 20-year capital improvement plan. So we don't have a specific location or targeted budget for that yet, but they wanted to have it on the list so that we're thinking about it and can start planning for it in the future. So we've added that. They had suggested some edits to the map to make it a little more readable. It is very busy. It's hard to read. Figure 8.1 is our overall facilities map, and then 8.2 is our trails plan map. So we wanted to simplify those, and so we took the Planning Commission's recommendation, and we went back and made some specific recommendations to our GIS technician, Mark Ramsey. And Mark is working on those right now. They're not ready for Planning Commission at this moment, but we can show you what we've hand-drawn that'll reflect that. And the first one, figure 8.1, what we want to do is get rid of all the extraneous information, get rid of the trails, lighten the parcel lines, lighten the loads a little bit. So what we're showing here is primarily the facilities. What are the primary parks within the city? So the descriptions will remain pointing to the parks, but otherwise we'll simplify that down so it's a little easier to see. We're going to also add the Little Side Trailhead on here because that's a key destination, key recreational feature in the city. 8.2 then is going to be our trail plan map, or it is our trail plan map. And what we're going to do to that one is take off a lot of the extraneous information again, lighten the parcel lines, lighten the streets, but bolden or make a little brighter via deleting some of the other things, the trails. So that's what you see in the purple here. And we've also added a number of trail connections that had been recommended through the process from the Mountain Sun Greenway, City of Snoqualmie, Forest Service, a number of partners that have worked together to find out where are the missing links. So we've added those, or the Parks Commission made a number of recommendations with that. We followed up with staff and made a few additional recommendations. So that's what you'll see, connection to the new park out here, which will be the Heartland property, the bicycle trail park that we've talked about, providing a multi-use trail along North Bend Way, or Bendigo Boulevard here, so that you're not just walking on the shoulder to get there. few other major things out as we get on 140th. We want to have a multi-use trail along there eventually to get people out to the whole Middle Fork Recreation Area. And then a kind of a mid-block trail connection in the Opstad Thrasher neighborhood. And that'll provide, hopefully, eventually a connection kind of between behind neighborhoods, like what you have over in the Sideview neighborhood with open space mixed with the trail that's not on the street network. We also plan on figure 8.2 to get rid of the bicycle routes just because it's too busy again. And what we want to do is create a new figure 8.4 bike routes. And that would be what you see in red here. And the bike routes map would then get rid of the trails and a lot of the other information just to clarify it and simplify it again. I think that's basically it.
Not sure that I addressed what we talked about. And then there was just a few minor corrections that we made based on your comments at the last meeting. Questions before we begin the hearing for the staff?
Yeah, just curiosity. So that you mentioned the bike lanes versus the trails. Are they, what's the word? Are they exclusive of one another at any point?
No, and that's a good point. The trail plan map shows multi-use trails. That's the intent. And we're actually recommending changing the symbol on there because the symbol that's on there right now is two hikers. And we want to change that or just get rid of that symbol and call out multi-use because all of those trails are suitable for kids on bikes and so forth.
Okay.
The bike lanes are on-road facilities, so those are intended as a single purpose for bikes.
Okay. And just a comment, too. I'm familiar with a couple of different things. One of them in Bend, Oregon, which most people have probably seen by now, and another one's Colorado and some in Florida. They've used rails-to-trails concepts, and once the trail's established, some sections of it end up getting paved. And the minute it's paved, a whole different group of folks will be on it. Everything from skateboards to high-speed bicycles. And I just am thinking about that as we develop this system. And then one other thing, just a comment. Has anyone talked about funds being allocated to purchase additional property where there are no connections?
Yeah, that's in our capital facilities plan. So we've got our 20-year plan that identifies a number of additional trail connections and then references the map there. And then there's, in the 6-year plan, some specific acquisitions that we want to go after via both easements and outright purchase.
Is it purchase of the easement space that we need, or are they actually thinking about the fact that, you know, the Smith property is 5 acres, and we're not going to be able to just buy the strip. We need to buy the whole thing.
It's context specific.
Okay.
So,
cool.
Each one's going to have its own characteristics.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Ms. Gildersleeve.
It actually a little bit touches on the paved area that you mentioned. One of the things as I was reading through this is not really feeling that we called out accessibility. So when you have, we have some trails that are passed that are explicitly stated right now that is planned for gravel, and those are not appropriate for individuals that might require wheelchairs or other assistive devices to walk. And I'm just wondering if that's even been something that's been looked at or discussed in planning, or to in some way identify which of those facilities that we have within the map are in fact accessible trails, particularly for the, I'm thinking mainly for the ones that are in close. We're wanting to create a walking center with the cottage residential and additional multifamily close in, and making it walkable means addressing the full population, which may be elderly.
Are these like classified as like an ADA compliant system?
Well, and that's where I was wondering where that comes into play, because I really wasn't seeing it called out explicitly, and if that even came up in the discussions.
No, we didn't get into the details of what surface each trail would be. I think it's again context specific. I think the general idea is the closer in you get, or the more heavily used it gets, it becomes paved and ADA accessible. Further out, the more to a more rustic, you know, off-trail experience would be, or not off-trail, but wilderness type experience where you're going through the forest mm-hmm. would not necessarily
be appropriate for Hinge, obviously, but I'm wondering if we're incorporating that at all in our planning so that it's something that we are paying attention to, because I didn't see the indication of that. So that was just wanting to get a little more feedback on the board in terms of how that would
the sidewalks all are, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so the sidewalks would be some of the trails that might, because I noted one in particular that was noted, they weren't sure if it's going to be paved or gravel, which made me start thinking about this issue of accessibility.
Well, gravel surfaces can be considered ADA compliant. It just depends on the nature of the gravel and
the grade.
The grade, okay. Yeah.
That's what I wanted to know.
So is the request to include that on the map, I would think?
Yeah, I think that we need to mention that we are thinking of that as part of the thought process to make sure that it's identified so that someone doesn't read this and see an absence of any acknowledgement of the need to do that.
I think a policy would be appropriate to consider appropriate ADA routes and design
identify.
Yeah.
Anyone object? Seeing none? Okay. And it's the identification of ADA?
That it is part of the process of considering the service, and that it is identified so that the information is easily accessible. Because some people may not want to go even try it. If there's some way for them to know that this is. And this is mainly, they redid a park that I was at, a national park. They paved it, a historic battlefield park in South Carolina, so that people would be able to actually get there.
Are you talking about coming up with a future plan for identifying on a map that we have today? I'm afraid if we identify on a map we have today, we wouldn't really have much.
It is something that will be reviewed as new parks are being.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so policy
that it's
level.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That it's noted.
ADA, just to add, I mean, ADA accessibility is part of the basics. Like when we look at a new park or we design a new park, that's part of the requirements that are implemented through the whole design process. So it's kind of understood, but a policy would reiterate it.
Well, and part of it was I was noting the signage. We were talking about getting the signage that isn't consistent through the city and making sure that issues that affect accessibility.
Yeah, I'll come up with
some
language for that.
Okay.
I was just thinking of where that might be, and I don't know too much about the toll gate. It almost seems like a track, and you could just pave that. I don't know what the long-term plan is, but yeah, like Mike said, you probably don't want to do it right in a forest, but that's an open meadow already. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Get some exercise. For sure.
Or at least making it possible for people who need to have somewhere to do that to know what parks they can do that at.
Any other questions for staff?
Mr. Chair, are you going to have questions after the meeting was closed?
After the public hearing, yes.
I missed all this last time. I have a lot of questions.
Absolutely. Yep. You can walk through it. Okay. So before I open up the public hearing, just you have 3 minutes to speak. However, recognizing you're from the Parks Commission, we'd love to hear all that you have to say and offer and be open to extending that time. Please state your name and address for the record. And with that, we'll go ahead and officially open up our public hearing at 7:16. Does any member of the public wish to testify on the parks element? Seeing none, we will go ahead and close the public hearing and open it up to Planning Commission. And Commissioner Ryan, would you like to begin?
If I may. Beginning with the Heartland Property Acquisition.
Your page number, please.
Page 21.
Okay.
Page 2. Deep into the description red, talks about acquisition estimate of $2.036 million for the property. Is that an appraised value, staff, or is that an appraised value?
Is that an appraised value?
What is the estimate based upon?
Yeah, acquisition is actually $2 million. It's $2 million. The 36 was closing costs associated with it, but that doesn't necessarily need to be in there. The price will be $2 million.
$2 million. And yeah. Is that based upon all the values of the property? I'm just wondering, is it land?
Is the
land currently zoned forest?
No, sorry?
It's residential.
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 It was zoned actually single family. Low density residential on one side and high density residential on the other, with a kind of a density cap of 45 units on the high density residential. So that's what the appraisal was. The appraisal came back at $2 million. This is ballpark. $2,350,000. Trust for Public Lands, based on the fact that the city was awarded, or the city side view in King County was awarded the $1 million grant, they did go ahead and purchase the property based on the $1 million grant. They actually stepped up to the plate and paid $2.24 million and are selling it to the city for the city side view in King County for $2 million.
It's a great price.
I
thought it was zoned forest, and I was really raising a red flag. I,
no.
The old rattlesnake ran 4.5 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have, these are single family lots we're mm-hmm. talking about. Okay.
And those are the number I know is our number we're paying, which is $2 million.
Yeah.
And the price they paid, the appraisal number is the one I'm talking about, and it's like 2.3 something. 2.3
something,
or maybe even 2.4. I'll have to look that one up.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I have a lot of questions. You want me to
yield? Keep going on.
And I apologize, I wasn't here last time. On the Tanner Trail construction on page 23, it talks about the right of way, etc. I live in that intersection, and that speed limit on that road is 50. And I would just pray that we would reconsider the speed limit on that stretch in there. Shut it down to 40 after 140th and bring it through there, at least a minimum of 40, maybe 35. But if we're talking about crossing that road with a trail, it's awkward sight distances there. When people are using that area for projects and whatever, they tend to crowd the intersection all the way around Tanner on both sides. You can't see when you come out from Tanner. You can't see traffic coming onto the road from westbound or up in the ways. It's a mess. So we need to put the speed limit down to where it's manageable and safe. If not, we need to put a bridge over that road where we can get people getting out of the way of the traffic.
For the trail
on overpass, like a quarter path.
So you're talking specifically the area where the Simplon Valley Trail intersects with North Bend Way?
Yeah. And with Tanner Road, Road just down the way.
But yeah.
I would.
Or roundabout.
I see it every time we have an activity there, that the activity is the focus and the cars and the traffic aren't even thought about. And it's just the be a total disaster waiting to happen.
So, Commissioner Ryan, I do support that notion. I was told, you know, it's not within the Planning Commission's purview. I understand our Public Works Director had also made a remark that the speed limit was awfully high for that stretch of road and was considering suggesting that it get lowered by the City Council. is there any movement or any news on that effort, or is there anything he's waiting on to go forward with that?
What I understand is there needs to be a speed study done to be able to reduce the speed, and the city has not embarked on that. I'm not sure.
Didn't it go to 40 before that intersection?
Not out there.
It's 40 before Mountside Road.
At 436, it changes.
Up to 436, it's 40, then up to 50.
Yeah, so you can see the sign when you're blowing through the intersection.
Well, I would just tell you this way. Until the speed limit is designed, we should not even think about improving the Tanner Trail at that intersection. We'd not do a thing to that until the speed limit is controlled.
You could actually, when you recommend approval of this, you could put that in one of your findings of fact that it's just recommended that the speed of North Bend Way be analyzed and lowered appropriately. That'd be in the staff report, not in the document.
And it would even be more important as we get residential development back and behind Tanner, all those extra cars coming in, just going to be... a real problem to have any event there at that trail intersection. Otherwise, I just can't see it working.
So, Commissioner Ryan, is that acceptable? We put that in what the Planning Commission findings are when it goes to City Council. And then I just have one question to follow on what you're saying. Is there anything that is in some type of regulations or standards about crosswalks across a road with a certain mile-per-hour speed limit? Do they... you know, have guidance that says over 40 is not recommended, or
that's
it has
correct.
To be a,
I think it's 35 is the threshold at which it's considered too fast to have a safe crosswalk.
Would that get caught when you do any traffic study to plan the trail?
Or those improvements would be done in consideration with larger scale improvements.
Okay. So
the projects that go on at that location, the generally terminus of a 23-mile event starting at Bass. But that activity at that point is an attractive nuisance that legally binds the city to doing something to protect traffic from being travelers to become disoriented. You see all these activity going on, they turn their head to see what's going on, and you have an accident. So they need to be pulled back from that road, get it off the road, get it off of the opening there by North Bend Way, and put them somewhere further south so they can have whatever they want to do further away from the roads. They aren't on the road. It's a total disaster. I can't overemphasize that. Going on to Bendigo Boulevard multi-trail use.
Before we go on to that, I wanted to see if is there a consensus from the Planning Commission to provide a finding in the staff report that will go to council about that speed limit issue. Association with Tanner Junction.
You also said to lower the speed limit or plan for pedestrian overpass.
Yes.
The trail. Can we include that in that statement? Would you be okay with it?
If fine.
We need to,
it's a safety issue for me.
To include that, because I think when you go, okay, do we want to spend the money to put a pass out here? It's too much.
You just went from 500 to 5 million.
That's my point.
Yeah, but some of our citizens' comments about having to wait in line, you know, behind two cars in this town might force the city council to spend that money so that we don't have to stop for a pedestrian.
You were headed that direction. I wanted to make sure that you had wanted to just go straight to the
conference meeting. Yeah, I figured that's the least expensive, but overpass would be the most safe.
Okay. Anybody else?
I support something like that because there's two kind of public safety concerns, not quite related to the wreck stuff, but there's like a pedestrian crossing over here by QFC, and there's like a flashing light that's actually at the wrong place, not even where people, the lines are, where people cross. And I've seen people halfway in the intersection, and then the other one's over by North Bend Bar and Grill, and I've seen a dad walking his kid in his hand, holding in her hand, and then another one right here, and then there's a person driving, and it's like they either don't see him, don't care, but I mean, we have kind of a crisis on our hands in this town, and you know, hopefully it doesn't take someone dying to like say, okay, we need a major overhaul of safety and pedestrian crossing.
Are you
I'm with you.
From what you observed, was that a speed issue or just they might not have seen that person?
It's really hard to say. I mean, they were going too fast, but they may have seen the person and not cared. I couldn't.
Or in a hurry.
Or, yeah, they just didn't feel like stopping, didn't feel like respecting it. But, yeah, brighter lines and, you know, whatever the standards are, I don't know. That's out there, you know, a flashing light or at least push a button or the flags. Anyway,
Mike, are crosswalks in the transportation element?
That would be the subject of the transportation element.
Any chance we can get that back next year?
The council wants to look at transportation issues broadly, so something will probably come back to you.
Okay.
And there's an activity at that 10 or intersection on North Bend Way. There should be yellow warning signs on both directions of blinking lights to advise that there's an activity, that they're coming upon an activity because you can't see it through there. So, are you looking for a motion on that?
No, I think we've got consensus. No one else was speaking against.
If there's consensus, though, I want to understand what the finding is. So, a recommendation that the Planning Commission staff report would include the Planning Commission staff report will include a finding that the Planning Commission recommends that the speed limit be lowered on North Bend Way in the vicinity of the Tanner Trail, Snoqualmie Valley Trail, in North Bend Way Junction, with appropriate warning signage provided.
Or plan for a pedestrian overpass.
Or plan for a pedestrian overpass.
So I would add, just with a focus on pedestrian safety, that's going to get where all your community go.
The next thing that caught my attention.
One second.
If I can move forward.
Just let him catch up.
Work faster, Mike.
Shorthand.
Okay.
Okay.
It was on the Bendigo Boulevard multi-use trail. At some point, that trail comes up against the roundabout on the exit. Now, I drive that exit. No one here drives that exit. We never really stop. It's a rolling stop. You keep going. At the best, sometimes you have to stay at speed and make that turn. So how are we going to provide a safe crossing for people walking or biking down this Bendigo Trail to get down to Ryberry?
So that intersection, that roundabout, would be a key focus of those improvements. That would provide some kind of perhaps lighting, maybe coloration of the pedestrian lane. We've seen like the green bike lanes, maybe the flashing lights, something to make it very visible that this is the way that pedestrians are expected to go. And
what side of the road will it be on? Will it be on the east side or the west side?
On the west side.
West side. So that's the blind side. When you come in under the bridge, you're not visible until you get into the curve. If you're on the east side, at least people coming off your freeway can see you crossing in front of them. But they're coming off. Their mind is getting around that turn and getting up to the next stoplight. They're not looking. And I don't see any cars when I'm making that exit. Any cars until they're in the turn. By that time, if I'm a bicyclist, I'm too late for that. I'm being hit.
As it's currently designed.
As it's currently designed.
Yeah. So this would.
But I'm not looking for colors and things like that. I'm looking for moving objects. So maybe coming down the east side, at least people going south on that trail will have a better chance of making it, because the traffic is not going to cross into them. There are very few cars crossing and going eastbound onto that intersection, but there's a lot of cars coming off the freeway and they're not stopping.
The proposal is the west side specifically because there's no improvements on that whole west side, and that would be a primary. There are some improvements on the east side already with some sidewalk, separated asphalt pathway, and the proposal is to do the same thing on the west side so that you have a safe bicycle and pedestrian area to get all the way from the levee system out to the new primary Heartland Acquisition property. And the west side does not have those, or has the bigger safety issues, and so that's where the improvements are targeted.
Yeah.
I don't know what the design's going to look like, but the idea is to make it as visible and as safe as possible.
You know, this would solve their problem by putting a bike trail over the I-90 and the, what street is that?
900 there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they made a perfectly safe bike route to get it off the freeway system. Probably cost the state a lot of money. but I don't see it's, I don't see it as being a responsible move on our part to put people in, at risk.
Well, it's a destination already, so people will go there, and therefore we want to make it safe. Therefore, the proposed improvements.
So then you put a stoplight at the roundabout for off Alamodi Drive, so they have to wait for something to get through there.
Again, I don't know what the design is going to look like. It may be something like that that has flashing lights or a red light when the pedestrian activates the that they want to cross.
Yeah.
It's yet to be determined.
Anyway, I'm making notice. I think it's a safety issue. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't accept the plan as written, or does anybody need that more in the plan I'm talking about? Positive safety elements in that.
I think the context is that this is the Parks Commission or the Parks element, so this is talking about park and recreation facilities. We'll also want to consider this in the transportation element with more of the transportation and on-road safety issues. So both will need to be coordinated and
I would have hoped together. The Parks Department would have at least indicated the safety risk being heightened as a result of this plan in some way, so people will be drawn to it. That's my significant comments.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Ryan. I definitely appreciate your interest in the safety of those who recreate in our area.
I don't walk as fast as I used to.
I walk as fast, but it hurts more. All right. Anybody else, any comments or questions? Commissioner Gildersleeve, please.
I know, so I thought I'd kind of want to talk about this.
Where would you like us to go?
I'll start to the first page. And the parks I mentioned earlier. And this is actually something I think that I mentioned before. And this is more in the realm of, I don't know if we called out if it could be here or if we consider it in findings. Which is not, I mean, I wear one of these all the time, but not everybody has them. And having some way in the signage, there are a couple things. One, let them know the distances they're walking. If somebody goes and does the loop at toll gate, what is the actual mileage in kilometers? And do that for each of the parks that has some sort of walking loop, to have that information available for the trails. The second thing on the signage was...
Before you move on,
yes,
I want to support that for a couple of reasons. That we not just have markers, but identify the trails. So if somebody calls for help, they have a reference point of where they are. Sorry.
You beat me to it.
Oh, okay.
That was point two.
Sorry.
Was having some sort of mile marker and obviously design what was appropriate, and to try and go with a simple system that, you know, maybe uses two letters that describe the trail and what that marker number is, and have that also act so they can know it's where they are and the distance that they're walking or biking. Now, most people that bike in this area, I think, are going to have something that's tracking that for them. But the idea is to make it community-friendly, and for those individuals that might not necessarily go out and buy a pedometer or some other measurement device.
Or just as a challenge with kids?
Right. Well, it's a different
get
type
to the
of
next marker.
And it's a different type of accessibility. Accessibility regardless of the economic, since we do have a spectrum of people in our community. And it's a safety issue if something happens so that they can describe in a way that's easy to find them where they are.
Yeah.
And yes, I've used that run to the next marker and can you get there and back before I get there, and it works really well.
So on that consideration, that's a really good suggestion. And the Parks Commission had already actually considered that and put together a decision card for the council this year for exactly that, for some park orientation signs. That's different from this. This was more about just replacing the existing entrance signs of the park. But their suggestion was also to have some signs that say Snoqualmie Valley Trail that way.
Mm-hmm.
And some key destinations like Mount Side Trailhead that way. The council, in their budget process this year, was not able to include that in the budget for 2017, but I believe it's in the reserve that we're going to come back at the mid-year budget amendment process, and that may be reconsidered at that point. Okay. But it's, I think, also a good suggestion
but
to actually put it into
the... But
is that
something that should be called out?
Yeah.
I think that my other thing was to not just say that this is... I know that we've commented about the fact that we have all these runners and long-distance hikers and bicyclists that come through town that go straight through. And if it's some of these crossings, we also have signs, similar to what you see on the freeway, indicating services, so that they know there's a hotel. If you go off the trail at this point, we have a hotel, or there's somewhere you can get food or fuel, you know, if they're...
Ripe bananas.
Yeah, you know, and again, that is bringing that system, which is part of the town, into the rest of the town, so that they don't go right past us.
Very entrepreneurial. I like that.
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't want to do that at, like, mileage markers on every trail, you know, like certain ones.
Key destinations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it was like the Heartland property has more mature forests than me, that, you know, you kind of want to lose a little bit of sense of I guess, development.
But somewhere maybe at the start of that trail, you put downtown North Bend or dining.
Right. And certainly name the property right there, like where you are. I agree with some of the
or a name for some of the side trails. I'm assuming there might be multiple loops in there so that they see that and they can say, I'm on this trail if something happens. It's just a way to give them exactly for that. So it's park specific, but it's trail specific, whether it's appropriate. And I was thinking a lot about that. What did you do? Some of the trails, a concrete post would be appropriate. Other places where you want to maintain the more naturalistic feel, you might use a stone that has been marked so that there's some sort of thing that blends in, but is still wayfinding in some way, and is a, you know, this big fancy sign and things. So I think there are ways to do that. And again, safety, and maybe get them to drop some dollars in our restaurants and our stores instead of just heading to Snoqualmie.
So, really quick, two things. Mile markers and trail identification. Everybody in agreement for something like that? Okay.
Yes.
And then signage for services?
Interesting idea.
So what I'll do is I'll take the information that's from that decision card and put it back into a project description on the 20-year plan.
Can I ask a question? There's already numerical marked signage on the Snoqualmie Trail. I'm wondering what that is. It doesn't. Some of the times I've seen it in blue, and it does appear to be a mile marker from something. I'm wondering if utilities have done that already or something's already happened.
I recall the county putting some mileage markers back in 2009 or something. And I think it was just from when it's the start of the Snoqualmie Valley Trail down in Uvalde or wherever it is, and then up.
Okay.
I think a lot of them, unfortunately, have been vandalized.
For sure. Souvenirs.
A lot of those markers are useful for trail maintenance. You can say it's between mile 6 and mile 7.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Ditch out or something.
So would that be a county purview or us?
That's the county. Yeah, they own it and operate the trail.
Right.
But we have our own trails.
And then the other thing on the signage was somehow on the signs for the parks, and there's a loop to let people know the distance that they've been walking.
You can do it.
Yeah.
Just a half mile left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we have that.
Always go under.
We don't want someone going around with a Sharpie and adding it later. You know? And that was not a threat, by the way.
Now we know.
I just make sure that sometimes I read my handwriting. I normally type this stuff. I think that caught it on that page. Speed was low down. We're headed in the right direction with that one. And then use case. So this is actually.
actually goes to tollgate, and it's a question, I guess, actually more for staff on that, because I didn't have the time to go back through the master plan and put this down. No lighting on that?
On tollgate farm?
For the fields. So the phase two include for the
fields. Yeah, that's right. And that was considering the soil conditions, that the soils out there are not suitable for extensive play, so nighttime play would probably overburden the field without having to go in an artificial turf surface.
Okay. And I guess my issue on that one was more this idea of maintaining the viewscape there, because even though the elements of the park are going in, it still has managed to maintain the feel of driving past that barn. There's not a whole lot that's in your face. The building's off to the side, the parking's off to the side, so you still get a feel of, not exactly what it used to be, but you still get that feel of a farm. And the lighting is something that kills that immediately. It takes it over and blocks that. So I don't know if there's anything in there that actually calls out trying to maintain that. The feel of a historic farm.
I believe the Tollgate Farm Master Plan from 2004 recommended no lighting.
Do you have a page 22 in your packet?
I don't.
Is there a reason why we go from page 21 to 23?
That's strange.
Or is it just the page numbering?
And then 25.
Well, I've got extra copies here. Are you missing all the
22?
Yeah, 22
and 24.
Okay, here's some extra copies. I'm over at it. 26 is looks like it's maybe missing all the details.
So I actually read it the first time with the electronic copy you sent. And when I went back through and started marking these up, I didn't notice what was
in. Yeah, in 26 you can see the off-leash dog park.
Oh, did you get a copy?
I was wondering if they didn't see a detail, but this is why.
Sorry about that. Again, I'm putting the package together and just hit the right button on the copier.
Damn machines.
I just had a question on the 8.3 map.
Scott, just one second. Elizabeth, thank you for your comments. As you look over that, if you have more, then please let me know. And appreciate all the sentiment. Commissioner Heller, sorry.
Yeah, very quick. Maybe all 7.2 County is listed as private protected areas, but I don't understand that. On the 8.3 map, it looks like maybe all 7 County.
No, I named the colors a little harder to see in the photocopy color, but if you look like at the cemetery, that's the private ownership color. And then everything in King County is public facilities with public or semi public ownership.
As far as that Eldred Park that would be created into a park, is that far end, I guess the western end of that Eldred?
Yeah, we're not showing that yet because it doesn't exist yet. Okay. Once that's dedicated, then we can add that.
Yeah, so we'd have a piece.
Yeah.
Somewhere within the ownership.
Good questions. Anyone else? Mr. McCarty, last meeting we had a discussion on the table on page 27. And my question was, is there a way to show what projects have been funded and whether or not completed so that the public can have a good understanding and accounting? Yeah. Is there any information you can provide?
Yeah, page 28.
Okay, which I don't have.
There you go.
Well, thank you for answering my question and for having it ready just in an instant. That is perfect. And if they want to know what the costs were, they can inquire with the city and somebody can get that? Or is it worthwhile?
I don't want to put in the cost because it's always so complicated because it's not one simple thing funded by itself. It's tied
it's
in
grant.
With this program and with this. And it gets really
sure.
Very blended. And
fuzzy math.
I understand there's builder contributions, there's public input, there's grants, and so dollar cost doesn't really mean much. Yes?
I noticed that on the Tanner Road park. That
Tanner
is.
Landing Park?
That was, what do you guys call it?
The Wet Water Access Park?
That's where they put out. There's a restroom being talked about. Just offhand, I didn't see anything about a parking area being provided or an official. Right now, they just park on the wide-out spots. So is there going to be an opening there?
For parking. It's not a park, but within the right-of-way of Tanner Road, as a part of the conditions on the Sagali preliminary plat approval, they're required to provide 90-degree angle-in parking within the right-of-way there.
And who's going to maintain that?
The city. City has right away.
Good question.
And then the park itself would provide a restroom and then a trail down to the waterfront.
Okay, there's already a road down there. Okay. That road keeps showing up on maps as a road. It really isn't.
It's not a road, but it is actually right away.
Yeah. Seeing at some point, someone's going to want to put a bridge back across that point, which used to be there. It'd be a tremendous asset if you ever needed that.
On the river right, the abutments
are
right
above your
house. Yeah, the abutments are still in place, and the river kind of dives in. I'm sure that the transportation people probably like that it's there because it could potentially eat into that corner on Mount Si Road that comes through. Because the river kind of bows out and it kicks off to the side. But yeah, there's definitely some fill that's still in place. I don't doubt it will ever get removed. So.
I had a conversation with someone at the county about that about 3 months ago. And it sounded it's that section is kind of like on their radar.
Yeah.
To watch for erosion.
Yeah,
I didn't ask about that explicitly. But
yeah, I don't know really if it's helpful.
Basically, we're doing things in there. But we're doing things
Okay, so anybody have any other questions or comments or changes? Okay. Well, given that we've had some good discussion tonight, yes?
I'd like to say that I made a shot at the planning at the parks, but I didn't mean that to be a shot. I think the plan is awesome. It took a lot of effort to come up with all these projects. I understand that.
Yeah.
The ones that caught my eye were the ones with my hot buttons. But I have high respect for the Parks Commission.
Well, I appreciate your sentiments, and I hope we can get that same energy when we finally get the transportation plan and we can make those changes for that. So I'd like to get the Planning Commission's sense. You ready for a question, or you want to see a completed copy with all our findings? What is it that you guys are looking for?
This is going to be for the council next week?
No, it would be in January.
Oh.
But our next meeting is January 8th,
yeah.
I think.
There's not an immediate rush on this. If you'd like to see it back, we could bring it back to you.
How many meetings do we have before the end of the year?
None.
This is the last meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to
hear the next one we were intending to cancel just because it's right for
practice. Yeah. Yeah. So if that's our sentiment, then definitely bring it back next time. Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate that. Okay. So the next item on our agenda is the introduction and amendments to cottage housing regulations.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have a chance to make comment on the
buildable lands.
Planning activity.
Yes, in the good of the order, I will welcome that discussion. I have a few underlines. Thank you, Judy.
Good night.
Bye.
Thank you.
Who would be leading this effort?
That's me.
Miss Eastep.
Well, this has been a long time coming. You guys have actually done, going through all the activities you have brought through the Planning Commission just recently. And Tuesday night, the council adopted the LID, remember your low impact development regulations that will be implemented at the east end of town, which will ultimately result in a neighborhood that saves tons of trees versus more of a clear-cut approach. So I was pretty happy about that. But as I was going through and Mike was working on this, I was thinking about our schedule. And I know city council got kind of had put their thoughts around this up until about August, and then your September, October, and November have been full. So here we are now coming back to cottage. You know, right now there's a moratorium in place on cottage housing in the cottage housing zone. So that is the orange area of town. So we're not talking about a big portion of our town. So what we are kind of doing, I do see this chapter evolving quite a bit in the next couple of rounds that it's going to come to you.
You say there's a moratorium, some of that's already under construction.
We have a polygon neighborhood going in with 40. Can't remember how many. Is that right? Maybe a little less. With about 40 homes. And
the one behind the ranger station, that's under construction.
That's John Day's. So we have two developments that are going on. And so the regulations that would come out of this process would be would apply to any new applications that would come in the future.
And the moratorium is only for new applicants. Any existing project that's already been approved goes forward.
Yes,
right?
Good clarification. So they were vested, so they're able to continue moving forward. So the goal of, I'm going to speak more broadly than worry about the details of this, because like I said, my thoughts are, as we evolve through this regulation, I do see already, but we just haven't had some time, I want to reorganize and do some things like that. So tonight I really just wanted to reintroduce it to you guys, get your initial feedback, and then go back and really start dialing in on the format and the content and really bring back more of a working document that we can start on. I kind of see, you know, council worked at this, they actually had about 6 meetings on it, so I see you guys probably having probably 4, because they did give a lot of good direction, so maybe 3 to 4. Anyway, so the gist of the cottage zone, it's evolved since it was created, but it originally intended to provide kind of a alternative housing option that was smaller in nature and could provide for, originally it was maybe an affordable option because they were size limited. They could be, an option that a new home buyer, a couple or a single coming into the building, the buying market would be able to afford, or an aging out person who doesn't need their 3,000 square foot house anymore and would like something smaller. So the codes evolved. Originally, it was much smaller. I think originally the first code was 1,200 square feet, if I recall. Then about 2 years ago, as a result of the economy crash, there was an interest by the council to allow larger homes to be considered cottages in hopes that it would kind of ignite something. And it did. And it not only the redrafting of the code, but also the economy coming out. So that's when you got the John Day moving forward and the polygon. So the code as it's written now considers a cottage to be 1,700 square feet excluding the garage, which is a pretty standard home almost.
Not a percent.
No,
the new regulations is what we've done, the city council, there's a couple projects that have been successful in the region. Kirkland has Kirkland has a good example, but the developer who developed in Kirkland was called Cottage Company, and they've developed actually in numerous communities around the area, and they've actually kind of, they're kind of at this point considered the builder that's nailed the kind of cottage scene. They design their neighborhoods around common greens, so it's not oriented around your driveway or your vehicular access like standard neighborhoods are. These are oriented around the social interaction across the green because your spaces are smaller. So it's more of a shared space. So the city council really liked what they see in Kirkland. So what we've done is we've actually taken the Kirkland Cottage Code and somewhat amended it to meet what our desires are in North Bend. We dropped the proposed cottage size would be 1,500 square feet, and it's, and you'll see when you read it, it's the idea is around clusters. So we have, there's regulations setting clusters of not more than 12. And in Kirkland, what they do is they see cottage as an infill development type of housing. So, you know, you might have a single family neighborhood and then you might have a real dense little cottage infill, but it's only 12 to 24 units at the max. And then they don't allow another one in close proximity to kind of keep that original vibe of the neighborhood alive and not super dense. We have a different scenario because we have a coal zone, okay? So I have to admit, this is a really intriguing code to write. It's actually pretty complicated. And that's why, because you guys get to participate in the writing of this, you'll see that as you write, you know, you start troubleshooting the pros and cons of how it comes out, and you realize you might tweak something. And so the part that I want to focus on tonight, and I actually meant to print a large copy, and I apologize that I didn't, is the map. So if you want to turn in, and I don't know why there's not page numbers on the front. I guess the parks element had page numbers and this one didn't, so that must be why. But if you turn to the map, the gist of what we're trying to do with this cottage code is to really look specifically through the area, coordinate traffic access so we can create kind of the intersections we want to see from a safety standpoint on Cedar Falls in the future. As you know, Cedar Falls has a tremendous amount of large, significant trees that line that street, and even the Polygon neighborhood to the south, Cedar Falls, did a good job maintaining those. So when you drive down that street, you actually don't see that Cedar Falls neighborhood. So what we're doing here is you'll see there's different colors on this map. And what the different colors represent is we're proposing, or the regulations basically are written to propose, that within this orange zone, we are going to allow a mix of cottage and LDR. And we're going to try and hit that perfect mix. It's a cottage zone, so we want to make sure that's the focus. But we don't want to have too much of any one use. So what we're trying to draft is a code that basically would result in the natural infill feel that you're getting in Kirkland, but more on a zone-wide, and that's the tricky part. So you'll see, on Stilson, if you just look at the Stilson, that is in yellow. And the reason we're looking at that, so in the next week or two when you're driving around, drive down Stilson, and you'll see there's actually some really big trees, and the street has a rural vibe. We want to retain that vibe. So what we're suggesting on that road is that that's where we're going to say, hey, this is where LDR would be appropriate, the lower density, okay? And then on the front of these larger parcels, parcels. We have Tanner Trail, and then you have some large parcels. We have a couple narrow, skinny, weird, or, you know, odd-shaped lots that are heavily treed. So we have on those decided that that would be a nice look along North Bend Way, or excuse me, Cedar Falls Way to maintain. So then what we need to do is as we penetrate the site, we're like, we want to line up intersections, and luckily the city owns a big chunk of excess right-of-way that has tons of trees in it. So we're going to, you'll see what we're doing is creating a new street standard for the sidewalk, where we're going to meander a sidewalk through it. So along the rest of this, what we're doing is we have this 15-foot sewer easement that has a sewer line under it. We're going to require the first 15 feet of any new development to provide for tree preservation, buffer tree preservation. And we're going to meander the sidewalk through that basically 30 feet. Most likely it'll be in that outer or that inner 15. So the whole goal is to design this road to meander a tree, keep those tree lines, so your overall like character of the road doesn't go away. So as you come in on the rows that you see, what you'll see is what we broke up by this, the orange colored, or based on the printer, red. Each area is kind of a, what we consider what where you might find a cottage cluster of 12. And then what we're hoping to accomplish is you have a cottage cluster of 12, and then maybe that cottage cluster is, you know, there's a band of trees and a trail that gets you to another cottage cluster. So really trying to integrate the environment into and around the cottages. So shy of laying this out for any developers, what we're trying to do is show chunks of property where we think it makes sense to do cottages, show the general gist that we want to see those tree corridors meandering through the whole block, and we're amenable to a nice mix of infill between the low density and the cottage. So that's kind of why this map looks very different than what you see just in one solid color, because of that effort to try to integrate the two uses. Let's see here, what else can I tell you that might be enough for now. Do you guys want to start kind of a discussion?
Questions on that?
What was the impetus behind merging LDR with cottage?
That comes back to the desire to kind of create a neighborhood that has a mixture of options, but also that's a lot of land. And if you put only cottages there, it's going to become quite, quite intense from that one particular use. The one thing, the smaller the house gets, the less you can manipulate and change the shape. So what we are trying to do is not create that sea of sameness by saying everything has to be 1,500 square feet or less, but rather integrate more like you'd see in Kirtland.
Jenna, have you talked to John Day or other realtors about the equity value or the increase in equity value on large homes amongst smaller homes? Are they going to get the same equity bump as if they were in the same kind of large home?
Yeah, that's a good question. That is definitely a challenge when you intermix different price points and different sizes and everything. The way this is done, though, is it is like a cottage, just like in Kirkland, you have the cottage cluster, and then you have across the street a large, normal, single-family house. And because the single family is proposed to be not part of the cluster, rather its own little neighborhood. It is potentially separate enough that you might, that might be less of an issue.
I see cottage homes as desirable, highly desirable.
Mm-hmm.
But I also see there are people who live in cottage homes that have a different lifestyle than other people in other types of environments, and I can see where there might be some conflicts and values between families and in
well,
the community.
Maybe one of the values of doing it this way is that everything is new. You're not bringing a cottage cluster into an existing neighborhood. This is a whole zone.
But everything changes over time. You know, cottage homes can become more worn, more shop-worn over time, just by the way they're used or abused by the owners.
Or
the larger home might not sustain that kind of use. I would probably not want to buy a home in amongst a cottage cluster.
Well, one thing to keep in mind that we're finding about the cottages, the buyers that are looking for the larger single family are different buyers, and they're usually people that are, they have families, they're young, they have families, so they need space, and they're willing to pay, their priority is space at this point in their life over maybe quality, to kind of, and so what we're seeing, or at least some of the gurus in cottage housing have spoke to, is the people that are buying the 1,500 square foot or smaller home, they're either a professional single who has done well and, you know, has, you know, for whatever reason, can is in a spot where they're buying a smaller home but can afford it. So they want nicer quality. Or they're a couple that's been, you know, they're downsizing. So they want high quality because they've already had the electric stove that doesn't work all the time, so they're looking for the Viking and live comfortably in a smaller space. So what we've heard is that these cottages are actually priced per square foot much higher than the larger houses. And so they actually are attracting people that take. I mean, these aren't affordable houses at all. It's...
So
which is one of the downfalls,
yeah. So, I'm sorry to hear you say that, because our inventory on low-cost housing is dismal.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the
away from that. We need low-cost housing, you're saying it's not going to be a low-cost housing.
It's not. Just because the house is smaller doesn't mean it's going to be less expensive.
So, Jenna, you touched a lot on the intermingling of single-family and cottage. I don't know if it's beneficial for the commission to make sure we all understand that in the zones today, as they're set up, in single family, what you can have in that zone, in cottage, what you can have in that zone, in multifamily, because they all kind of intermingle anyway,
yeah.
Right? I'm just not sure if anybody takes advantage. If you're zoned cottage, do you build multifamily at all in that zone, or we just haven't had it happen here? So is the Planning Commission, do you understand in each zone that we have options to build? Okay.
There's probably been a meeting somewhere that somebody spoke to the point I'm going to try to make briefly. I've followed cottage housing since they got started in Kirkland from Whidbey Island. And it's been a favorite development process. I absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. But the roots of it go back to a kind of a hippie-style co-housing concept where people shared a large apartment building down near Berkeley, or they shared a converted old motel where they faced each other and they had a communal garden. I mean, that was 50 years ago. That was the same folks that said, okay, well, now we're older now. How can we apply this to the real world? And they went into the development cottage company particularly and did this across the country, not just here. They found a niche in urban areas with, exactly as you said, infill, hard-to-build-on properties. One of them in Kirkland on 135th, which is somewhat original from that perspective, was, I believe, a five-acre parcel that had a lot of sensitive area, steep slopes, and the value of the land was damaged by that. Nobody's going to build a single-family home up on the street when they had a steep backyard. So the cottage company came in and said, hey, we'll do this. We'll cluster, I believe it was 10 or 12 units facing each other with a meandering pathway between the homes on a front porch. Everybody had a little front porch. Their parking was remote, basically not typically attached to the building, in some cases below, but generally most cars were not part of the structure. And another key ingredient was they're on the main drag, so there's a bus line there. They had relatively quick access to, you know, schools and other things that were nearby. And that was a proving ground for this cost per square foot analysis. Not only did it get a deal on the land to start the process, but as those homes resold, they grew exponentially to the ratio of other homes that may be twice as large because the demand was there. And I think we're at this kind of neat little spot where generationally our population is saying, hey, you know what? Either because the divorce rate's pushing 70%, two people moving out, or because my parents are slightly younger than them are living by themselves because they lost one or the other one, but they're also writing a check for the space that they want to live in. So I think it's a great, huge, unique opportunity. I'm a little questioning how we've kind of, I'm not as excited about blending two different zones into one, but if that's what it takes to get it to fly, then let's go with it. I think it's the, as they say, it's the future. It's not necessarily, because it's a small square footage, it's not necessarily going to be habitat-type product.
Jim, was that what you were calling a hippie environment back in the 60s? Back in the 40s, those were called courts.
Yeah.
You'd have four and one. You'd have nine units, four facing each other, one at the end with a center walkway, sidewalks going off each front door, back doors in the back end of it, cars were on the back.
Yep.
It was a real tight cluster. But damn if that wasn't popular.
You
really got to know your neighbor.
Yep. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
Arguably, our society's gone away from that.
Yeah. They were two-bedroom units with a living room and a kitchen, basically.
Yep.
Well, thank you both for the history lesson. I want to get us back, and your point on blending together, is it a different mix you would be looking for, or you just want to
I think we're struggling like every place is. Every city's trying to go. Cottage housing is demanded. They know the economies are there. The developers are around. They've already tried it, and it's true. It works. And now the cities, like us, are saying, you know, we're really not sure what to do with that. I mean, as Jenna just pointed out, the first thing we did, the first couple of years we had the zone in the first place, builders were coming in and wanted to double the square footage because that's what the economies for them worked. So we're doing a balancing act here again.
I'd like to see an economic analysis really about having a larger home, 2,500 feet, sited in amongst cottage and duplexes. Are these two units also called duplexes? Or is there a difference?
Yeah. Duplexes are two
units. Just a shared wall.
Attached, yeah.
Oh, one other piece of this, and I'm not hearing it. There was a physical communal structure. I'm maybe using terms that are kind of loaded. But they'd go so far as to have a common kitchen.
Yeah.
In the Kirkland property that I was just mentioning, 135th, they've got a common kind of a, like a lot of apartment buildings, complexes do, where you can kind of open the space and have a party there. It's got a cooking area and a place to hang out, and maybe there's some storage in that building. But it really does, it creates a really cool place for people to live.
Did you see that atrocity on the front page of the Times today?
Which one?
Picture.
No, I didn't see the Times today.
Picture. Did you guys see the picture on the Times today? It was freaky.
What's the picture?
It was a new apartment building being developed at the U District. 130 square foot units. Toilet, basin, shower, open, no enclosure.
Yep.
It was called a cell. Basically, it was basically a prison cell, mm-hmm. and they had a communal kitchen. They didn't pay any utilities. And they're getting $750 for this per unit.
Yeah.
Imagine. Well, so they had a picture of the side. Swear to God, guys, it looked like just a wall in terms of its width, and then went down three stories down that way. My God. But I guess students who don't want to room with somebody are buying into this thing. It's going up.
Professors.
You're living in Seattle.
Yeah. So let's. All I can say is, please let's keep this cottage housing conversation going.
I like
it's,
that.
It's a really cool thing.
I see it being profitable for the large landowner, you know, amongst the smaller. I think they're going to.
So back to your economic question. Are you looking for some kind of study of housing prices that were built in the same year as the cottage?
I want to make sure it makes sense financially as well as aesthetically.
So we don't have funds in our budget to do an economic analysis. What I would say, though, is developers are doing a number of different things now, one of which is their, like John Day did it, where he bought the Tanner, he platted the Tannerwood plat, and he sold half of it to Richmond America. So the way I see that map happening from a developer's mind is you would probably get a cottage company to come in and build the cottage cluster, and you would get a John Day or a typical single-family builder to build the other neighborhood. We aren't asking that the cottages be literally intermix them. We are allowing for that economic opportunity for different builders with different models to succeed within this area. What we are trying to do, though, is like just like you would see it down here, like down here in downtown, you have a mix of housing. You can build a cottage in downtown North Bend, you can build a big home, or you can build a duplex. The reality is, if you're a builder, which we have one on 2nd Street building 5 homes, so that builder is going to build 5 of the style that they build. And that, well, the nice thing about doing it the way we're doing it is I should be careful when I say this, the larger corporate builders are looking for large, numbers of homes to go. But if you have a neighborhood like downtown North Bend where you can only build 5, you are going to attract different builders. And so the nice thing that I see is you're creating an opportunity for many different builders to invest in North Bend. The big ones will hit to do something different than the ones that are going to buy 10 to 16 homes.
Builders are important, but the livers are more important. You have to get people to live in this.
I'm just responding to your economic question is whether it's...
Yeah, well, the builders can build it. I just said that. But if I'm a home buyer, I'm also a home investor, and I want to be able to know that I'm going to have equity growth in my investment in amongst all these variety of homes. That's my question.
Well, mix is desirable to a broad market. I think that's one of the things that was popular with Snoqualmie Ridge and Kimball Creek Village in Snoqualmie is they were deliberately a mix of different housing types together.
Well, and our gig is more about creating the opportunity, not getting into whether it's economically feasible. That's going to be up to them, right?
Well, there's a lot of things that go into whether the property appreciates or not, one of which is the style of the original builder and whether they build a great product or not. But just like downtown, I mean, the nice thing about old communities, like, naturally, you would have smaller houses kind of in the middle of the block, and then the corner lots are bigger. And so, it's a good question. And I thought about it also, but I think that the way this is set up, you wouldn't see a big difference in appreciation of your investment.
Are we in our Vulcan and Mitchell standards working through architectural type work on this any differently? I'm just imagining. What's the extreme of the low density square footage? What's the high end of that possible building, for example?
How big can a home be? We don't see much over 4,200.
44,000. We don't really even see it on many 4,000s.
So just imagining next door adjacent, because that the zone the fact eventually meets itself, right, to get two come together. One of them's 3,800 feet and the other one's 1,500 feet. It's like the guest quarters for the main house.
Well, the way this is laid out, that's part of why we say there needs to be a 30-foot tree separation. 30 feet's kind of a lot in the grand scheme of it. It'll be a nice quarter through.
It's almost a lot width, right? 40 feet would almost would be a lot width.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm saying it's not a huge amount of space, but like, I recently, and if you guys ever find yourself interested to do this, it's actually a nice thing to do. Snoqualmie Ridge is riddled with trails, and most of them are all 50-foot buffers. And I recently took my bike up there to see what that felt like. And now, 15 years down the road, as we think about some of these buffering areas, and if you go behind the business park, a 50-foot buffer with the right vegetation actually does a pretty good job for an urban area. Of course, it could always be better. So in this scenario, I think a 30-foot, because you don't want to create walls and you don't want to wall them off. What you're trying to do is just sprinkle in nature and blend it. So I just don't see a big issue with a 3,000 square foot house next to it. I mean, but my house is 1,000 and my neighbor's probably 3,000, so I'm fine with it.
Yeah. Would breaking it up or, you know, having to really breaking it up this way be more enticing to the smaller home builders that you're mentioning? Because I guess I feel like that, looking at what's happening elsewhere in North Bend, large tracts, mm-hmm. You know, and who knows what they're going to look like. I guess we have to have faith in our regulations and whatnot. But wanting to steer away from them and pull in more variety, smaller developments of 3 or 4 or like smaller lot size. I mean, without being specific, my new neighborhood that's going up is really unattractive on a number of levels. And so not wanting like mass new developments like that, I think would be in line with our
small town and rural character. I guess
right.
Smaller scale or diversity.
And so mixing, like I guess, so it kind of brings up another point. You have mentioned, like, do we know what cottage really includes? Because the label cottage is somewhat misleading, because it doesn't include the multifamily or the single family that can be mixed in to that zone. So
it does or does not?
It doesn't.
It does. Right now, the way... Oh.
I understand that that's what can be included in it. But if a developer is just perusing our zoning maps, oh, that's cottage, I want to just build cottage, and maybe we want to consider, I don't know, changing the name so that it makes them look into that. Because, you know, looking at that, it's like, oh, I can build, you know, if I'm this builder who just builds cottages, and I see that, sweet, I want to put all these, you know, similar looking cottages in there, which isn't really what we're shooting for here. So I guess my two points are, one, do we want to, you know, how do we advertise, broadcast, that it doesn't just have to be cottage, and it can be a variety, so that might be enticing to a certain type of developer. And then also, how do we, you know, encourage them to break it up with this, because I think that would provide a lot more rural character along there and the rest of the other cottage. So.
Okay, so... this regulation or this packet of regulations doesn't necessarily encourage. It's actually saying this is what we want.
Okay.
This is how we're going to regulate. So, for example, it is saying that along Cedar Falls, because to get that tree-lined native natural street to retain, we're saying we want to have the first 15 feet basically dedicated to... And for tree preservation. So you can't develop that. We're saying that. You can't develop that. You could put a sidewalk and meander through the sidewalk. And then we're also saying that through the site, we want to get those tree corridors. So those are all right now regulated aspects of it. I think we need to be
be probably more clear on what those look like and how they're implemented when we improve our regulations here. So that's one thing, is right now it's not necessarily looked at as encouragement.
So if I can kind of elaborate on what Curtis was saying, Polygon comes in, they bought this 20 acres, and it's own cottage. How does the discussion go? Is there any, hey, did you know that 10% of this can be multifamily and the rest can be cottage, or some could be low density? You know, how does that go, or do they just come in and this is what I want to do? And
yeah. Typically, a builder, they have people out looking all over for land. So they get the gist, they know, that's what they do. So what they usually do is they come in and they start inquiring about the regulations that are in place. And then we let them know, this is how it's laid out. And some builders will say, okay, well, we build cottage and we're only planning to build 24 cottages, but we have an option on this size land. So then they might go look to sell the rest to a different builder, a John Day, who builds the larger neighborhood.
So I guess to follow up on what you're saying is the city council is going in this direction, but the zone allows for other things to be considered, like multifamily. So how specific will the code get, or will this get, to force into low density only and cottage? Are we going to amend the actual code? Or?
Yeah. So the idea is right now you have your performance standards all for cottages in a cottage performance standard. We're going to actually create a chapter called cottage. And whether we call it cottage and mixed housing or what we'll have to think about. But let me put my train of thought on your question.
Well, it's just, so they're going to create this new zone or redesign this cottage zone, is what you're saying. And so whatever was written in our land use element is going to be outdated.
Well, your land use element right now has, not necessarily, right now your cottage zone actually allows for standards. You recall we allowed standard single-family houses to be implemented into it. It also allows up to 30% multifamily. So right now, your cottage zone allows the same mix this does. What the council felt when they saw Polygon is that these houses aren't cottages. We want to see smaller cottages. And with that, they started really discussing what cottage looks like and how do you do that smaller version. And the cottage company does it well, and they all agreed that that's kind of the gist we like. Well, if we only allow cottage in that area, we're going to have a lot of tiny little homes, like hundreds of them. So that was when we started going, okay, well, you guys were all okay because we marched through with this mix with allowing standard homes. So let's continue that gist, but maybe do it more so it's, show how the infill will happen based on the map versus what we said before is like for every one home under 1,500 square feet, you got one standard home.
Mm-hmm.
And the city council really felt like the cottage zone shouldn't be designed like a standard neighborhood. It should be designed like the Jim Lucky description of cottages. Around the greens, communal. You buy into the culture of cottage.
Different lifestyle.
Yeah.
I think we're not in it. I know you would agree with that. Is, why did we have to keep monkeying with the zone? Why not keep it when we designed it and just see how it develops and goes forward? And I support going back to that smaller size. I'm just leery of being so descriptive and, plotting out all this land to that level of design.
So, when I said I think this code's going to evolve, tonight what I'm looking for from you guys, because I have to say, there's a lot of work I want to do with this. part of it is that, because at some point, fires are organic. They don't come and go, okay, I just will get, you know, like you might find a buyer that, or a seller, that's selling one of these parcels, and ironically, that's when the cottage company wants to buy, and they'll come to us and say, we have the yellow color here, but we want to buy that one. Could we move the yellow color over there? So we got to think about how to move that flexibility, build that flexibility in the code.
Mm-hmm. This is just an example, of a possible.
Yeah. So somehow we're gonna do that, and I've been thinking that one through, and I haven't. And that's not in there yet. So this is step one of your review. For me, what I'd really like to hear is, what is your kind of parameters of cottage? How do you see that area? Does anything that I said not resonate or resonate well? So as the planners go back and start bringing some better drafts forward to you, what, you know, we have your thoughts in our minds.
Janet, does the opening, the development that's occurring next to the church on 436, does that conform to this?
No.
That's under the existing.
Was that a cottage zone?
Uh huh.
But it doesn't conform to this.
No, because this isn't a. This is still going through the process.
So is this being established because that project wasn't giving us what we wanted in cottage? Or I don't understand.
I don't know if it's necessarily any one cottage. I think what happened. I mean, I've been here for the 3 rewrites of the cottage code. This is the 3rd one. What I see happen is pre-recession. Yeah, there was a lot more opportunity and a lot more builders. The recession hit, and there wasn't much happening. So I think that there was an interest to say, well, you know, we are maybe not downtown Kirkland. We have a little bit different demographic. Maybe we should create a more flexible zone. John was basically trying to get his off the ground, and he was, you know, he had told us that he didn't feel it was viable based on the economics at the time. So anyway, the council decided to amend the code and increase the size of the cottages. And now we're in a different economic world. Plus, not only that, we're actually in a community now that is in a hot market. People are looking to buy here and build here. And the only way to have a diverse community for age, married, single, blah, 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 is to provide housing choices. So now I think the interest is to drop the size back down to actually what would be considered.
Just what I want to say, so everybody understands me, if that clearing is an example of a cottage, the start of a cottage community.
Mm-hmm.
Under any standard, they missed it, because not only did they not conform to the spirit of the code with leaving trees, they've also cut into the BN right over the grade on the north side of that lot. It's everything we don't want in terms of amenities. They don't have any. They've cut right up to Cedar Falls Road. They didn't leave anything, except trees along the northerly line, which don't mean anything in terms of the quality of the estate being developed there. And I don't understand. If they are not in sync with this, then, and there's going to be cottages in there?
There's going to be houses that meet the current cottage code.
Okay.
And those, Dick, those were built under a cottage code yet to be revised as we're doing it now. And it was even, I'd even go so far, because I think I could say it, maybe some others can't. That was a kind of a dream state when it first got implemented, and the economies pushed the city council to screw it up. And that's what you see, is somebody trying to fit a square peg in a round hole.
That cottage... not to get into the details of that one, but that cottage development, when you go through there, once it's done, you have a loop road. But once you get to the end of the road, it's going to you're going to rise up onto a moonroof and come around. So it's going to, that whole back area will be designed to be more of a living street. So the developer actually implemented some unique character in that neighborhood that I think once it's actually designed, they did meet our tree preservation retention, I know,
I agree,
regs, and they worked with us to, instead of just sprinkling on the like the east or west, bring, you know, they left the 12 in front that we meander the sidewalk. This one is actually saying that, you know, there's a 15 foot you got to stay out of. So moving forward, though, this is an opportunity to get a much more small-town rural character. We're in a moratorium, so we have some time to do it, right?
Jenna, as a commissioner sitting here, I want to insist, as much as my insistence counts, which ain't much, but that the builders conform to our code, and we don't bend to the builder's wants. The builder didn't leave anything standing on there. They were encouraged by the code to leave trees in the cottage.
And they met their requirement for the code.
Yeah, if that's so our requirement, we stick.
I think I'll speak that I, for one, need to better visualize the words on the page into what it looks like on a lot. And as we read through these documents, maybe that's just, you know, something we all keep in mind, that you envision what the finished product looks like. Having said that, I went down and looked at what the elevations and the plans are for the site. And if we publish those as what it looks like, you know, in a couple of years with all the trees, then it becomes a lot more of a, oh, okay, I understand they're planting a bunch of trees, and the way that they're doing it, it's going to be more aesthetically pleasing. I also, you know, have gotten the sense from the city council that, you know, their feeling of development in the city and the densities that people are voicing frustration over, that are, you know, how radical would this be, is our low-impact development become low-density residential? Our current LDR become medium or high-density residential? You know, is that what their sense is? I don't know, but hopefully we can hear one day what their ultimate goals are.
There's another example that's probably worth visiting. To me, this example, and I'm going to use Beaux-Arts in Bellevue, that's a natural evolution in what eventually became a very expensive area. And those homes are still very small. They're tucked in and around the trees. You got to pull over for your neighbor to get by. That to me, is a cottage neighborhood.
So, Jim, Beaux-Arts has been mentioned a few times. Yep. I've heard that. If you look at this rendering here, is that more along the lines of what it looks like from the infill point of view?
I think, yeah, and I think we'll never, you couldn't design Beaux-Arts. You couldn't spell that out and do a good job articulating it. And I'm always concerned about, we do a great job, and every planner on the planet has their heart and soul in it to do it right, but what you put on the paper and you design in the code and the guy comes and starts swinging a hammer, at the end of the day, it's not what everybody had in mind.
And that's why you come back and refine.
Exactly. And I love the fact this is the third swing at this, right? So if you haven't been to Beaux-Arts, go down there, take your bicycle if you can. It'll get around a lot easier. And the other point I was going to ask about, I remember our now soon-to-be park was kind of on this road of cottage, meandering single-lane road to address small, you know, one or two units per building kind of idea. And I'll make one more kind of request. As we start blending zones, which this is unique, right? We haven't intermixed zones like this that I can think of. We've started one for the next. If there was a way to add another section in the code that would call, that might be still called cottage, but it would allow a developer to address their 10, 15, 20 acre platting process, and actually pull some land out that is otherwise difficult to build on and allow that to be a little cottage inside their plan at their discretion, because that's the root of the cottage housing at Kirkland. It's hard to build on, steep slope, challenging lots. Now you've got a cottage housing development. Then we could actually have the cottage zone use spread around a lot better.
If so, that is allowed, go ahead. That's allowed under our current code. So in the low density residential zone, cottages are allowed for up to 15% of the overall number of units. We haven't had a builder take advantage of that.
Right, yet. I'm just thinking there's probably not an incentive once they get the train rolling. They're just going to turn it into a park, or they're going to swap it out, or what are they going to do?
Well, the difference is the one thing that Kirkland does well that I don't know if we're ready for based on the input from our council is the way they did that is they were able to, or the way they, because the Kirkland was actually flat, I thought.
Well, the one I keep thinking of is 135th.
The it's Daniels a,
it's Road. A, forgot
anyway.
The yep.
So in Kirkland, what they do is they allow you to go two times the underlying zoning. So if your underlying zoning is 4 dwelling units per acre, a cottage development can be 8. But it can't be more than 12 units around a green, and you can't have more than 24. And then you can't, once that happens, you can't have another one within like 500 or 1,000 feet of each other. So
it's half the density across the lot. Too.
Right. So what we do, what I think the reason why it doesn't necessarily happen in North Bend is our code actually says you can build a cottage in the LDR zone or even in downtown, but it's on the same size lot and at the same density. So there isn't the density incentive that Kirkland provides. Now, what our council did say, and this is why there is a discussion on adding a 10-minute walk diagram, is if you look at downtown North Bend, and you look at a 10-minute walk diagram, it basically brings in these and some up here. And that would be where you might want to consider, like here, you know, because that's one thing, cottages are all about walkability and stuff. You know, that's where they seem to thrive. So that's where that question will come up is, do you want to see cottages in some of that LDR as infill? And implement something along those lines. So that's kind of, we might go there.
You know, Jenny, a couple of years ago, you were a strong advocate for these corner commercial centers that makes walkability.
Yeah.
All down that corridor, 10 minutes to any commercial center.
Yeah.
You were very strong on that. I support you on that. I think it's a fabulous idea. Let people walk to the store, let people walk to the cleaners or whatever, mm-hmm. and have those commercial hubs dotting along North Bend Way. Mm-hmm. And we still, is that still in the mix of planning ideas?
Well, it's designed such that, like, at the corner of Mount Zion Road, and yes.
I mean, that 10-minute circle, that's a good vision.
Right.
Not just for the downtown core, but for pockets of communities.
Yeah. I mean, right now the city council is scheduling their annual retreat for January, and it's going to, I think, be heavily oriented to land use. So this will all, you know, having you guys start this process now is kind of a good time, because we'll have one meeting on it. You guys will come back to this in January. Meanwhile, I'll have time with them to flesh out more of their vision, because, you know, you do have council that have come, 3 new ones have come together, so they are fleshing out their vision as a group. And then I see the moratorium will be extended in, most likely, because we're not going to be done with it, in February. And meanwhile, you probably have some new things coming through at the same time, and this will be evolving out. So it'll be a good year for land use topics, let me just say. It'll be fun.
I think your language in the code on tree retention is soft.
Okay.
I think that you're saying wherever possible. Well, that's left up to the developer. It's never possible. So there will be a minimum amount of trees. I think you need to be a little more, just incrementally a little bit more Is there anything about trees? When in doubt, trees fall first. What I see out throughout is it's kind of hard. Don't take the trees. It's do whatever you can.
Okay.
Should we have a special consideration for a tree size, like 24-inch diameter or 36-inch?
That's going to survive a storm. We all know about trees. But there was a sufficient mix of trees on that lot of 436 that they could have left some. They were not candidates to blow down.
So
we do have that. So we have a tree section under our clearing grading regs. And Mike will know it right off the top. 15?
Yeah, so 30% are required in a standard single-family residential development, retaining 30% existing significant trees. I think that goes down to 20 or 15 for a cottage development, and that was acknowledging that it's just higher densities, harder to preserve, less risk of trees. But that's where we could rethink that.
But the size of the significant tree to be retained for a conifer is, like, is it
15 inches in diameter.
Yeah, and then the deciduous as well.
It's my understanding, that within that replacement trees and the percentage that will cover would be sufficient for anything that they cut down beyond that percentage. Is that correct?
They are required to replace any significant trees that are removed, either on-site directly or off-site via a fee in lieu to the city. Say then uses to buy other.
So that's kind of my, like, in just wanting to, as we go forward, like, it was my suspicion driving past that new development up by the Cascade Covenant, is they found that loophole, so, which is really disappointing, and I think we are, you know, that's a consensus. So how, as we visualize this, do we close those loopholes?
Well, that's not a loophole. They still did retain their minimum requirement. And that's where we just need to think about what that
this new phase prevent that from happening.
That's exactly it. Is taking what we envision for these developments and putting it onto paper. Is it
it's
that
hard.
You want trees retained throughout the lot, not just on the edges?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and many of those trees may not be quote, significant.
Right.
Okay, so I'm hearing all you guys, and I think what you're going to see is once you get your brain around this and we improve these, there's a couple things you're saying. Number one, I've always thought, hey, I like to live amongst trees. So when we brought the tree regs together through the Planning Commission, and I remember the allowance to going down, we set it at 30, and somehow it got down. That was one that I was like, darn. So, one thing is just citywide, we can look, you know, so at some time we should look at our tree preservation regs. That's kind of on the list of things that we're, been talking to council about. But this is an opportunity right now, because it's in a moratorium, nothing's coming down until these regs are adopted, to say, and that's where right now we're not just saying, we want 15 feet of tree preservation. We also want to sprinkle through the site. So in this document, we can clarify that's 30% tree retention throughout the site in addition to this and that. And I mean, that's where we need to, we also need to be cognizant that, like Mike said, once you start putting density around trees, there's got to be some flexibility for safety in that, this and that. But, especially like those trees along Cedar Falls Way, they've been exposed to the wind for years. It'll be one, you know, once we cut down on that.
And not only that, but I remember in past planning commission meetings, like that area was identified as like one of the major gateways, wanting to retain that character and that visual. And so, yeah, I guess I think you're on the right track, right?
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. My concern is, like, as we go through it, like, we see these small lots here.
Uh-huh.
And so if those aren't all bought at the same time, you know, like Mr. Lucky often points out, the person that owns that, it's their property, right? And so they ultimately have the decision. Right now we have an opportunity to influence them, create incentives for all these, I mean, these three, four, five landowners to preserve those trees. So, yeah, like, let's not miss this opportunity.
Yeah.
I think
thank you
for this.
Yeah, I think we're all on the same page.
Yeah. I like the map and kind of having some things drawn out. I think it would be good to look at some aerial photos and look at that existing village, like Curtis is mentioning, and find some of those significant trees that already exist.
It may need to be specific to what we don't think of right now as significant.
I think
if we've defined
right
it larger.
Now, so a significant tree is a conifer. You know, it's a Doug fir is going to last 500 years, an alder 100 years maybe. So those trees that are along the clear cut basically that we're all talking about, those were alder that they left. So those maybe have 50
those
years.
Those break down to 60.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, they're just, that's not long term. So those might last our lifetime, but that'll be about it. And maybe there's some maple, I'm not sure.
For clarification, our regulations that was reviewed under, an alder is not considered a significant tree, so that's not a part of what they're required to retain.
Okay.
The other thing to keep in mind, there's more trees than that were, and a lot of the alders are actually on the Tanner Trail property. The other thing that we have, just so you guys are aware, our code requires that if you take down a tree, you either replace it 3-to-1 on site or somewhere else in town, or you pay us for the value of so they ended up, they'll end up having to pay $40,000 to the city, where then what we do is go revegetate the city.
What I think, though, is that's great, but I think that we're missing the boat on the rural character.
Absolutely.
I think what everyone's saying in the room is looking at this drawing, and what I'm saying is finding those significant trees that exist now, and I'm not, you know, what's done is done on the other. I'm not getting anyone's case about that. It's good to hear the significant actually means conifer.
It doesn't mean conifer, but it exempts alder and poplar.
Size. Diameter.
It's based on size.
That's the key. The dimension, size of the tree.
So to kind of get to where you're going on that, this is the aerial, not that you can see it, but the entire, this big chunk of land right here is that big, wide city right away where the white extends. So what we're saying in this is we're doing that exact effort that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think in this, where this little triangle is, and then up into here is some forest as well.
Right, but when you're writing regulations, we until you have an application on file, we don't go onto people's property and do that
level
of survey.
You have some, what's the great parts that you have drawn in here?
Listen. Right away with the end, right?
Oh, I see what you're saying. That is where we're saying we want to see the tree corridors and the.
So what I'm saying, let's put those where existing significant trees already exist. I think that yes, you can clear cut, replant 3-to-1. You know, and in 100 years it'll look great. I just think that the more that we can, especially if we're going to start on a clean slate, let's just try to. Put those buffers in areas where there's already existing trees.
But I hear what you're saying. Is that feasible? I mean, is there a way to?
Yeah, I mean, we've already
that
been kind
height?
Of doing that. We're doing it with even the consideration of City Hall. So yes, where you want to write, instead of like trying to nail it, what you want to write into it is. See, what this, there was a mixture of ideas going on here. There's some there's trees where these are, but they're also aligned with the intersections below. And what the thought was is you're driving down the road, if you have a tree-lined street and you look up to the street and it ends at trees and then Mount Si, your visual space is staying green. So that was the other idea, is having the terminus of the streets to seem natural. And where those commingle with perfect or with the forest is ideal.
In this, I think in this one, it's pretty hard, whereas in the one that was just clear, it would have been fairly easy to have natural clusters throughout there. I mean, I don't know if there's anything left in the city like that now. But if there is, then it would be good to weave through instead of wiping it, replanting it, reestablishing. I think that's what. I don't know what the council believes that Northwest citizens think the rural character is, but that's what I think the existing is what they would like to see. And I know when the other places replant, the bridge is replanted. I mean, in some ways, it doesn't look bad. It's looking better as you drive through there. I mean, I agree, but I just mean we have to follow suit.
Right.
Right. Elizabeth, and then.
I really like the idea of the trees and the terminus. It's one of the things that's great about Sixth Street, is that it just, the end of it sort of melts into the mountain there when you drive home at night. The other thing is that I'm looking at the placement of this property and the kind of mix and putting these in the family residential. And remembering the public hearing and a lot of commentary that we heard with regard to this specific parcel and concerns with cottage residential or multifamily was the fact that it comes up right against where the vet keeps coming out from the school and where you have the little loop for the single family residential that opens onto the road right across from it. And I think that keeping the feel of those single family homes that are across the street actually addresses one of the concerns that we heard repeatedly from the public about this specific section. So that I think is actually a potential real positive for the public when they see this, because then it's someone hearing that concern and coming up with a way to try and address it.
Mm-hmm. That's what we were debating about, that being high density residential.
But they were also talking about the cottage, and there was a lot of concern expressed about the cottage and the fact that they could end up with a bunch of houses in there. And it was the commentary with the offset is right down there. And then across from the, I'm trying to figure out where it is compared to this. There's a little, so right in there. And then you have, I think it's the Forest Homes, that is the subdivision that kind of opens up right on there. So we had a lot of comment from people in that area and parents of kids in Austin about that big increase. And this is sort of a, hey, we're listening and we're trying to come up with something.
Mr. Lucky.
I don't want to be long-winded. I'm just thinking a couple of different things. So from a developer's perspective, they're almost always going to write a check and cut a tree. Because probably, and I'm just being real general, he's going to have X number of lots, and there's one lot with a bloody tree on it. The lot, if he could build on it, is worth $100,000. Gee, do I write a check and pay for a few trees? Or do I leave the lot there? And the only reason he'd probably leave the tree is if it was an amazing tree that added value to development. So there's a decision that some rational person is going to make based on their budget.
Let me provide a clarification on that, too. They're required to retain the minimum number. Whatever they clear beyond that, they then have to pay the limit.
And I guess I get that, the 30% or whatever the percentages are. But there's another, and I'll be cynical when I say this. If the person plats the land and meets the criteria to protect the trees, by the time the roads are built and the first few houses are built, there's been heavy equipment running around in the land, and the few trees that he met fit 30% with are probably going to die, right? He knows that. I've seen it happen a dozen times where builders go in and build 50 houses. They've saved five trees, and they've waited for the last two lots to build on those because they realize they're going to die, and they end up cutting them down and building a house there. Not all the time. That's real world in my mind. And then I'll make one more comment. If you go to really old neighborhoods, kind of, I think about downtown Seattle, Broadmoor neighborhoods, there are no trees on people's lots. There are trees on lot lines and trees at the street. And if the neighborhood's old enough, it's actually canopied. So as we start talking about protecting trees, I'd almost rather we talk about protecting trees or making plantings happen where they're probably going to stay. The idea of saving a tree because it's in a certain place, long term, the guy who builds a house there someday is going to cut it down if he can. The ones that stay are the ones that are on the perimeters. So I'll throw that out.
Thank you for your comments. Anything further on our cottage or any asks for us? I heard look into cottage company, Snoqualmie Ridge, 50-foot buffer, and Bogart's in Bellevue. You recommend biking it? Okay.
Or walking. I mean, you could drive it, but it's...
Better than biking in the winter.
Well, yeah. Unless you're daredevilish.
Well, who knows? Maybe we'll get a warm day.
It's a cool spot.
February, usually.
Yeah, let me think. Is there anything else? This has been good feedback. I think it sounds like we're all kind of on the same page in the realm of what I understand. I mean, tree preservation is big. We want to maintain that small town rural character. We understand having a mix is good. Dialing in on that mix is going to be a challenge, so we're going to have to work hard on that. Creating the flexibility in the code while creating the requirements that so there is, you know, clarity in a code is good. It gets prescriptive. As long as you know what you want to prescribe, it's a good thing. So that's where you got to balance that because it takes away the creativity sometimes. So we'll have to nail that. So this will be an interesting endeavor in the next couple months.
I was just going to add what I also feel, and from being here for a while, is you have frequently added in all the other requirements. And so where you have 30% tree preservation, you have your open space requirements, you have sidewalks,
right.
You know, and you have setbacks. And so out of that 20 acres, there's 15 or something that
yeah.
get built. And so to understand what that impact is, I think, is also part of our discussion. That has to happen.
You know, when you talked about in this plan, you incorporated the Breton Northern right of way as an element that could be negotiated with the builder in terms of leaving 40% of the right of way for trail and then buying the additional amount for lots and things like that. How wide is that right of way? Is it 100 feet?
The Tanner Trail?
Yeah. The
yeah, it's
yeah, I get the Tanner Trail.
100 feet, yeah.
That's usually what railroad right-of-ways were. Well, that's a lot of right-of-way that's being used by other people, then, isn't there? Have we sold off part of that right-of-way to somebody?
Well, it's not ours
yeah.
to start with. We're trying to acquire segments of it.
Oh, I thought, by reading this, I thought we had acquired it.
No, what we did is we wrote a really good section of code because the Tanner Trail is estimated to be at around $3 million to buy from the railroad. So what we did in the last code is we said, hey, developers, if you buy the railroad in frontage and build the trail for us, you can keep 40 feet or 30 feet and give us the rest. So ultimately, we would have a 70-foot corridor and they would get a little more buildable area. That's what they exercised. They actually did that. So when that plat gets complete, we will own the frontage in front of them, knocking off a big chunk of that, you know, cost that's going to cost the city to buy up that corridor over time.
Yeah. It just seems like when you look at the grade, is North Bend Way on the edge line of the Burlington right of way?
Yes.
It is. So if I were to pace off from North Bend right of way line, and go south 100 feet, am I going to be in right of way?
Well, it's never that accurate. I mean, the edge of right of way and the edge of the roadway often don't align. So we'd have to get a survey to know for sure.
I know that.
You're just looking for a ballpark.
But I'm just looking for ballpark. I think there's a yeah. lot of the 100 foot that's it's under third party use. They just assumed they've.
Sure.
I mean, there's fences
yeah.
everywhere on there.
Yeah.
It's everywhere
yeah.
on there. So,
adverse possession on the railroad?
Yeah,
it never
works. But okay. In the back of my mind, as we talk about incorporating these trails, the Snoqualmie Valley Trail and the Tanner Trail, in with residential properties, I'm very concerned about unwanted trespassers. People who walk the trail all times of the day and night. wandering into people's backyards because these trails are so close to these developments. It makes me very, very nervous that we're inviting mischief by putting the trail so close to residential properties.
Well, one way to look at it, or an alternative way to look at it, because we do hear that a lot.
What do you do about it?
Well, an alternative way to look at it is when you right now there's, you know, not a lot of there's not a lot of homes close by or what have you. But when you invite people like families and people walking their dogs and their kids and their strollers, the people that are there for the wrong reasons go find different places to be inappropriate. So the more you can invite the right people, the wrong ones move on. And it happens everywhere. So it is a nice part of trail usage that you see all the time. It's like the Middle Fork. The Middle Fork used to be riddled with meth heads and dumpy cars that got shot up, and now that's all cleaned out and hikers are using it, and that's just because now the right people are there enough that it's not attractive anymore for the others.
But these trails are cross-country routes for homeless and wanderers.
Just say hobo, Dick.
Okay. Well, they're going to also become a major amenity for the developments that occur along that trail. That will become the front door to a lot of those developments and the way for those residents to get downtown. So, like Janice said, it's going to clean up over time and become a real amenity to the neighborhoods.
Okay.
And as traffic...
someone has dealt with this over...
You thinking if we change the...
Whether the trails there or at someone's backyard, they still walk through. And I think that when you have a trail where there is a constant public presence, it isn't a friendly place to be. Because someone's going to call and report that they saw a guy doing, you know.
At mile marker 32.
Yeah, and there would be another reason to have those. I saw a guy who had a squat in the trees off the trail.
Yeah. Just going up the trail towards first youth camp is just past the river. There's a whole area there. It's all laid out flat where tents were laid out. Yeah. Just a quarter mile from your office. And they do sleep out there. Mm-hmm. And all I'm saying is that they do get moved around with police support. They're not moving around because of the good people walking around. The police actually create the movement. In my opinion, my observation. But I'm just saying, I'm just wondering if we're really thinking clearly about using these trails as so close to the residents as an amenity at risk of the owners that live there.
Well, the owners certainly always have the right to fence the property, too.
I don't have a concern with that. I mean, I think the best thing that ever happened to the homes along Lake Sammamish is the fact that you can walk out your back door and Issaquah or Redmond.
Or UW.
Yeah, and that railway, that corridor used to be kind of a sketchy little corridor that nobody used, and so the wrong people used it, and now everybody's using it. So I like the idea of trails. And so I think, but it's all a perspective everybody has.
No, but you raise a valid point, you know. We'll see what happens when we get some apartments built.
Another great thing about that particular trail, the Tanner Trail, is just right next to the big, very busy North Midway right away, so it's very visible. I think you would not see a lot of illicit activity because it's so visible. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I'd throw another thing in the mix, because I'm thinking you're talking about the width of the setback.
Yeah.
If the non-privately held property is not right on the trail, then there's going to be a question of, can the public stand there at my property line? Or, you know what I'm saying? So if the trail abuts the property line, then the owner of that property who lives there is probably going to say, hey, dude, move along, versus this wide buffer, which is kind of a no man's land that anybody could stand on or camp on. I'm just throwing that in the mix. I mean, I totally get your point, but I think there's also, put a fence up. If the trail's maintained, you know, Johnny with a tent's not going to be inclined to stay there.
big issue too with the road safety. I see people walking alongside of the road all the time, and not often for whatever reason. And I think maybe because they don't know that they can do that,
mm-hmm.
Or that it's well, it is part of the stuff. But so having that there is going to improve safety for people that are walking on that road.
Put up a few more cougar and bear signs. That'll keep on.
Or a few more sightings. Well, thank you for your introduction.
Yeah, thank you. And it's a great two conversations.
So, go ahead. Anything further on this?
Are you going to do a good of the order?
I am. Before the good of the order, I just want to remind the Planning Commission that our next meeting for December is canceled, and our next regular meeting is January 12th. The second Thursday of the month. With that, good of the order, Commissioner Ryan.
Well, I just want to say a huge, awesome job. There was somebody that said on City Council, the builder, who said you guys are overworking. Hire people. And when I look at the projects you guys have going, I say, you're damn right you need help. Are you getting help? Are you getting more staff?
Public Works is getting some additional engineer help, which will also help our office, because that will help things to keep moving through.
This, I read Mike McCarty. When in the devil do you get home and get away from this office?
I keep fairly good hours.
But how do you guys get through? I don't know why you're working on such a skeleton crew. What? Where is that even? Who's not responding?
You want to come to? No, I'm kidding.
I'm serious.
No.
Do we all need to go to City Council?
No, we're. We're like right now. I think. We're doing okay. The engineer's been backed up, but as we move to a lot of land use, I see next year as a huge land use visioning and code writing year.
Can you contract some of your work out?
We are doing that, yes.
Yeah. It comes under a different pay code, right? A different expense code?
It's usually passed through.
Because I really am worried and concerned about the pressure you're under and your ability to respond. You know, to this discussion like tonight, you know, timely response. I think you really are way beyond the limit. I can see it in your eyes. I know that you guys are really under pressure. I don't know who the hell to talk to that's going to make fix that. If this was a corporation, you would have doubled your staff to handle this kind of work. No question about it. And you are bringing in assets, income into the city by moving this paper and moving projects through. So it's not like you're not bringing money into the city. Why the hell aren't they using it and bringing help? Who's the stopgap?
What are we, one of the lowest tax cities in Washington? How do you get there?
I think we need to buy him a beer and have further conversation.
Off the record. Or I go burn down Lonnie's desk or something. Off the record.
Can I throw in something else that sort of relates?
Are you done?
I'm done.
Okay. He did this. I'm supporting.
I'm supporting these.
Yes,
people.
I second that.
We appreciate you.
Second that. Yes.
Jim?
I was just going to acknowledge that, related to the work ethic, obviously is there. We've been in the last 15 years, my math could be off, a water moratorium, an economic entrenchment the minute we got out of that, and we've had a couple of years of breathing, and now we're back into another one. And I guess I'm just... It's a good thing from the perspective of being able to plan and dial it in, and that's exciting. But I also don't want to
lose the energy of what the economy's doing at this very moment. And then I'll add a single comment of my own, personal comment about the market. I don't think we're going to be doing rocket ship dance in 2018. Don't see it happen. So maybe the moratorium is going to help us in another way. But thank you for being there.
Thanks.
What is the word? Let me try this. So you put your fingers up like this, and you hope the economy stays as good as it is right now.
Rocket ship dance. Thank you for the illustration. On the Biblical Lands Report, Connor Holmes, 48 SFRs. So he's ready to submit, or what does anticipated project mean? Can you?
Connor Holmes, which one is that?
LID what development.
Oh, they actually put an offer on the property. And I don't know where exactly that offer stood, but they've been watching our progress on the LID. Last I talked to him, he was still engaged in kind of answering some questions that I had about whether certain provisions, one of the council members had a question I asked him, and he got right back to me and said they were still planning to move forward. So we are hoping that, you know, if they exercise
okay.
that option.
That's
on,
fast.
Yeah, on the LID.
That's very fast.
Yeah.
See that come to light. King County Wastewater Division Truck Maintenance Facility. Do we have a location on where that is, Mr. McCarty?
Yeah, it's just north of.
Showing on the map.
Out at exit 34, right here. Between 144th and 146th.
And how is that in relation to where we're discussing, like a KOA or a
campsite?
Yeah, the
campsite. It's north of there. They'll have a pretty extensive forested buffer between the street and their use, though.
And wastewater truck maintenance facility. Okay.
Got They're it. Not doing any wastewater processing there. It's just the trucks that are in operation.
What's the Meadowbrook Farm Bridge?
That's a pedestrian bridge that will go from the Meadowbrook Farm Interpretive Center via a trail out on the what's called the Dyke Road Fields to the north of the primary Meadowbrook Farm area and connect out to the Snoqualmie Valley Trail. And it has to cross a fairly large wetland via a bridge.
Got that.
Yeah, sure.
Is it replacing the existing one?
There is no bridge there now.
Caves.
Okay. On the restaurant that's going to be built next to the post office, what is the access westbound to that site?
Westbound, so coming west on.
If you're going west, as you're going west past the circle, the only way to get in there now is crossing under the post office. Is the access going to be from the post office?
Yeah, road? Same driveway. So they'll access. They've got.
So there won't be any access on the North Bend Way from.
No, there won't be a new entrance point.
Okay.
Page 3, number 19. La Quinta Hotel, and it says MF on the other. Yeah. It's after 9. Multifamily. Can you tell us anything about that? Because that would be. I don't know of any other multifamily we've had.
Are those under PARs?
It says active commercial. I don't know why that's on there.
Oh, that's because of the short part of it. There's a gentleman that's interested in the Wersch property at exit 31 for a La Quinta and multifamily. We don't know right now if that's how realistic that is. I know, you know, you remember our design standards for hotels require usable balconies, so I would be surprised if La Quinta starts building that kind of hotel. So it might, if he wants to build a hotel, it might evolve to something that meets our standards.
Got it. And multifamily?
It's allowed there.
But do you know how many?
I have not.
Because that's just the first one I've known about, right? We've had apartments, but not multifamily development.
Multifamily is a general word for duplex, triplex, or apartments, or condos, or anything attached is considered multifamily.
Okay.
keep going on questions like this. On the page two, which is has the Pulte Group, River Glen, you're saying that model homes are no longer being allowed due to grading issues.
They are required to confirm that their grading is consistent with the grading plans to ensure that they're meeting the zero rise requirement under our floodplain regulations. They've not yet finished that analysis, so we're not allowing them to do any further work.
So, not knowing all of that background, I'm just reading that model homes, they're building model homes to preview their construction. They're not going to be able to build that until...
Yeah, model home permits were granted for the project, and our code allows for up to 5 model homes to be constructed prior to completion of the final plat. But because they haven't yet demonstrated completion of this grading issue with the floodplain regulations, we've said no more until you finish that.
Okay.
They've redone that 5 times now.
And I see I left that firm. Research.
So, yeah, it's been a challenging thing for them to get straight. Really.
When you use demo, is that demolition or demonstration?
Where do you see it?
Well, on page 3, down there on 22, Rivers 2 West. Just a
demolition in that case, yeah.
That's a demo. Yeah, demolition. Just trying to get the lingo.
Well, big thank you, I think, to Tom, right, for providing this report.
This is
very valuable, not only a recognition of what your efforts are in this way, but also to enlighten us to what's happening in the development of our city. And
thanks, Tom. What's going on? You get this message.
Yeah. Has everybody logged into their city email account and noticed that their email will be migrated? Anything over 30 megabytes will not come over. I did a quick search. I don't have anything bigger than 5, and they were all from Mike McCarty with all our planning commission attachments.
It's tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So are we going to, I didn't see in the email, are we going to have
good
to
set it up? No big deal to us, but you guys.
I printed it out. I didn't read it all about the setup. I don't know if anything will be different.
I didn't mention anything about new passwords or usernames or anything. I didn't know.
We'll be able to use our existing password. Yes. We might just have to set up your formulas and things for typing in. You won't have to worry about that.
Well, the only thing I get it on is my phone.
Okay. And then lastly, I had made mention a while ago, and I want to just state this again, that some people on our planning commission have served for quite a long time, and I've seen on other cities' websites that they might recognize people either third term or fourth term or since this date. And I'd like to thank Mr. Lucky just in some small way of recognizing him for all the years he's put in here. Is there some way we can get on our website something to reflect his tenure of service?
Sure. I'll send Tom an
email. Something about dating yourself?
Tom is awesome about updating our email, our
website.
Yeah.
So take a look at Bellevue or Issaquah. Their planning commissions, they might have like a term since or fourth term or something like that.
Party requirements.
I hadn't thought of that. Gary?
I don't know how long it's been, but it'd be nice to know so we can at least recognize you in some way.
Thanks for that. I don't think it's necessary, but whatever you suggest, I guess.
With that, anything else for good of the order?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
75 years ago, this was a day that was called the Live in Infamy. It's also the day I came crying into this world in a blackout. And I'm still in the dark.
Welcome.
I'm 75 today.
How are you?
Happy birthday. Wow.
Yeah, I was born when the Japanese were bombing the Aleutian Islands up the way.
Wow, what the heck of a birthday.
Yeah,
it's kind of cool.
Well, happy birthday. 75's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to do this year that's special about turning 75?
Live in 76.
All right, that's fine.
Hot boy. All
right. Anything else for good of the order? Well, thank you all for coming. Wish you a safe and happy holiday or Merry Christmas, I'd like to just say, and I'll see you in January. Motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Planning Commission is adjourned at 9:25.